Hesh, Hesher Dude, Hesher McHesherton, El Hesherino, and Hesher the Magnificent.
Who calls him that?
Brian McClain is Hesher on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
That's right. Welcome back to today's News Talk. You got Hesher on the mic here. Thank you for joining me for this show. If you missed any of the live presentation here, it'll be up at tntradio.live shortly after the broadcast, so do get in there. Check out those archives if you haven't yet. All right, Pfizer and BioNTech, everybody's favorite ghouls. Pfizer and BioNTech will begin trials of their updated mRNA COVID-19 vaccine designed to protect against the newer BA.4 and BA.5 subvariants of the coronavirus. Great. How do they really tell those things apart? That's what I want to know, because I have no faith in these PCR tests whatsoever. BioNTech announced on Monday joining other vaccine makers like Moderna, who are trying to create updated shots targeting the faster spreading and immune evasive variants. Oh, really? Is it faster spreading? Is it immune evasive? Prove that to me. The trial announcement was included in BioNTech's financial results for the second quarter of 2022, where the German vaccine maker reported a total revenue of £3.2 billion or $3.26 billion, lower than analyst estimates. BioNTech and its American partner Pfizer have started manufacturing bivalent. That is their Omicron Bravo Alpha .1 and Bravo Alpha .4/5 vaccines that will offer protections against both, against the fast spreading newer variants. The company claims it will be able to roll out the updated shots by October in time for potential fall boosters if it receives regulatory approval. Pfizer and BioNTech have already carried out clinical trials for BA.1 Omicron-focused vaccine. It was shown to produce higher neutralizing antibodies against the variant and have submitted the findings to regulators. As per the FDA, vaccine makers do not need to submit updated clinical trial data for their BA.4 and BA.5 adapted shots. The agency will instead approve the modified vaccines, not the right word, using clinical data from the BA.1 vaccine trials. This will allow updated vaccines to be approved quicker. Great. I'm going to just stop that one right there. Quicker? Do we really need quicker approval on these things that are already experimental? What is the FDA doing here? What are they doing? We're just going to blanket approve this stuff? I guess so. That story's out of Forbes and reposted at 21stCenturyWire.com. I don't know what to say about that, folks. They're going to just keep doing this. They're going to keep rolling these things out. They're going to keep using the auspices of emergency to keep rolling these things out. And the FDA, what are they for? What are we really paying these people for anymore? Did you know there are many ways you can listen to TNT Radio? Why not stream us direct from our website on your desktop, tablet, or mobile device, or download our app from the App Store? We even stream live on YouTube, Rumble, and Odyssey. We got you covered on TNT Radio.
Stay in the loop all day.
And the only radio station that helps me through a long day.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, we've got Pat Jordan joining us once again. He's a career law enforcement professional. If you've been listening to the show, he needs no introduction. Pat, welcome back to the show. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Brian. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Never had it so good. It's great to be on air with you once again. Lots going on in the media. Lots going on in the news. I don't know if you were listening to earlier in the show when I had CeCe on, but there's this story coming out of, I guess ABC7 is sort of the breaker of this story. But yeah, there's this story going on out of San Mateo, which is really kind of just blowing me away today. I was avoiding it because it's about a Batman car, and I thought this can't be serious news. But when I started looking into it, we played the clip earlier. The sheriff in San Mateo County, Blasnos or Balnos or something like that, apparently is connected to a real estate mogul named Sam Adignastio, and Sam purchased a he did an online purchase of a Batmobile, a replica Batmobile, over $100,000 replica from a mechanic slash craftsman in Indiana who specializes in these replicas. And Sam, the guy that purchased the car, he missed some payments. He missed a number of payments and was unresponsive for a number of months. So the gentleman, Mark Raykop, who owns this company that makes Batmobiles, he did what any normal business person would do that's making custom order, things like that. He took Sam Adignastio's car and put it at the back of the line because he had missed payments and he was non-responsive. And when Sam discovered that his delivery wasn't going to happen when he had thought it would, he called on the sheriff of San Mateo, and the sheriff of San Mateo whipped up some charges against the business owner and set up travel for a team of four officers, a couple lieutenants and sergeants, I think, and flew them out to Indiana to serve a search warrant on this guy. And they froze his bank account, and they were going to get the car for this real estate person and bring it back all the way from Indiana to San Mateo. Charges were filed. It looks like the DA may have dropped them since, but what do you make of this one? I was just blown away that this is a use of public funds for a sheriff's department.
Well, I'd only heard the story from CC, but as you lay it out, you know, obviously I have several issues with it. The very first thing is it's not unusual for very rich people to call to the sheriff and cut through the red tape on legitimate criminal issues, right? But this is clearly a civil matter. You know, they had an agreement, and one felt the other. They both had conflicts as to who was following through. But to actually fly four investigators to another state to serve a search warrant, which is really highly unusual. How can they get a judge to sign a search warrant for a property in another state in California is surprising to me, right? So I don't think I've ever done that before, and I really don't understand the mechanics of that, but I would think the judge would go, because think about it, the warrant has to be, you have to present the probable cause to a judge. So what judge signed it? I know I wouldn't if I was a judge. I'd say, how about we just let these guys handle it in a civil manner? So yeah, I think that sheriff has a lot of explaining to do. And I think ultimately, because it's become a national story, it's probably going to cause him just a little bit of pain, and it probably should.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like a gross overstep. And as Cece was pointing out when she was on, what is the story? Like, it seems like there should be a big piece of investigative work there that would sort of shed some light on the connection between this real estate guy, Sam Adignastio, and the sheriff, or maybe the judge. I mean, I don't know. There's got to be something more to this when it comes to the relationships of the people involved, I would suspect.
The unfortunate thing about it is I really believe in the importance of the independence of the sheriff, the position of the sheriff in the county. And I think there's been a push both here in California and nationally to get rid of the office of the sheriff and make those appointed positions. And I think that is an absolute mistake. And unfortunately, foolishness like this just makes it difficult for people who make the argument for an independence of the sheriff when sheriffs like the one in San Mateo County, it would seem on its face clearly oversteps the bounds, right? And so he does himself a disservice. That's kind of why I have some frustrations with my former boss, too, is, you know, I was up at a conference up in Santa Barbara, and the Santa Barbara sheriff sat down next to me. He talked to me. He says, you know, what your boss does in L.A., it reverberates throughout the state. So every time one of these sheriffs does one of these high profile brain farts, it impacts sheriffs everywhere. And so when you get elected to the office of sheriff, you have to understand the importance of your position and that, you know what, there's only so far you can go, even as an independent sheriff. Now, he's doing a favor for a friend. He overstepped his bounds. He used, sounds like he used taxpayer money to do that, to get involved in a civil matter when he shouldn't have. And that it obviously he's going to pay the price, but unfortunately it just adds fuel to some of these politicians who just want to get rid of the position of sheriff so that they can appoint sheriffs like they appoint police chiefs. And we saw during the demonstrations last year and the year before that, a lot of police chiefs, they failed to live up to their oath and protect the community and community property during these demonstrations. And I have to give kudos to my sheriff here in LA. He got out there and he dealt with the demonstrators and suppressed looting in the areas that we're responsible for. But we saw looting in LA, we saw it in Long Beach, we saw it in Santa Monica, and we saw it in other places around the country where chiefs really ignored their obligation. You know, when you make an oath to protect the Constitution and enforce all laws, you make that oath with the people. You don't make it with the politicians that appointed you. And a lot of chiefs looked at the political realities and the employment realities and made decisions that were not in the best interest of the community. So that's why we need independent sheriffs. And so when sheriffs like this guy in San Mateo County does what he does, it just gives all sheriffs a bad name, and it makes it that much more difficult for people like me who advocate for an independent sheriff position. That may not address exactly this issue, but it does talk about the broader fallout of maybe his ethical failures up there.
Yeah, that makes good sense to me, Pat, you know, because that's the whole point with the sheriff, right? That's an elected official. So if your elected official does something outside of their oath or outside of their representation of their constituents, at the very least, they are risking their reelection, assuming all elections are above board. We hope they are. And, you know, this does make that difficult for people who are arguing for the importance of that. I mean, gosh, if we were to have appointed sheriffs, what would that even look like? I mean, our system is already so corrupt. And we've been talking on the show about how the Biden administration, the Clintons, Kamala Harris are supporting, you know, people running for mayor in LA. It's like, do we really want to be in a similar situation when it comes to our local sheriffs in this country? I would certainly think not.
Well, let me give a real reality of why it's important to have an independent sheriff. And so you mentioned Kamala Harris. So when we passed Prop 47, Kamala Harris, she was the attorney general at the time. And in this state, the attorney general looks at the propositions that are written, and they help to devise what the title for the proposition will be. And so basically she said Prop 47 would be the Safe Streets and Safe School Act. And it's proven to be anything but. It reduced the sentencing for a lot of folks. It basically decriminalized drug use and a lot of other stuff. And it ended up causing an increase in street crime. Crimes in schools are less safe. And so the only person really speaking out against it at the time was our independent sheriff, right? And so she was part of the political machine here in California, the Democratic political machine. The sheriff, you know, he bends to that political machine, but he also was independent at the time. I think it was Jim McDonald said, no, this is not a good idea. And he was against Prop 47. And he was one of the few that was speaking against it. And that's why you need an independent sheriff, somebody who you can look to and you trust that says, hey, this is wrong. We shouldn't do this. Additionally, when Jim McDonald was in office, so that's the previous sheriff, they passed some legislation to restrict who you can turn over to ICE, right? And Jim McDonald fought that, and he got it modified. They still narrowed who you can turn over to ICE at the time from county jails, but he was able to fight to make sure that narrowing wasn't quite, that we could still get rid of violent felons or repeat criminals from directly from our county jail to ICE. And you need an independent sheriff to do those kinds of things. And that's why it's really important for the sheriffs to recognize the position that they hold within the states that they are elected in, not just the county, and how important their independent and their position is. But more importantly, their independent voice to speak up when really bad ideas get put forth by politicians driven by folks who, like the ACLU, who really aren't, don't believe in any form of incarceration. We need our sheriffs to speak up and challenge those guys on a regular basis. And when they're corrupt, if a sheriff is corrupt, then it just gives all sheriffs a bad name.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not a good time for that. So, Sheriff of San Mateo, if you're out there, do us all a solid and be better. You can be better than this. All right, we're going to pick this up on the other side of the break here. I'm joined by Pat Jordan, everybody, one of my favorite law enforcement professionals here on the Brian McLean Show. We'll be right back. This is today's News Talk.
TNT Radio's Trish Wood.
I'm telling you, there is something going on Twitter. They're going into election season. The Democrats can't win on any possible thing they're doing. They're just losing. And what happens with the Democrats in the states, because all of the big tech companies are affiliated and siding with them, going into an election season, they are asking for help with censorship from the big tech companies. And we finally have proof of that. We always thought it was true. It was alluded to a fair bit by Jen Psaki. And now we find from a lawsuit that was just resolved in one way or another that a treasure trove of emails obtained by America First Legal tells a far more alarming story than what we ever even thought was going on. The 286-page stack of correspondence reveals a cozy and daily working relationship between people in a position of control between Twitter, Facebook, Google, and the Alphabet power dynamic in Washington, the CDC, the NIH, and also the World Health Organization.
Trish Wood on today's News Talk, TNT Radio. Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
You'll never abolish the Department of Homeland Security until you abolish America's world empire. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to TNT. This is the Brian McLean Show, and I am joined by Pat Jordan here. We're talking about sheriff's departments. We're talking about this thing that happened in San Jose with regards to a Batmobile. I can't even believe a Batmobile is the source of all of this madness. Now, Pat, I'm wondering, when it comes to sheriffs, how does this work if a sheriff can a sheriff decide not to enforce things that they deem unconstitutional that maybe their local politicians have dreamed up or federal law? I mean, is there any sort of discrepancy there for the sheriff and his deputies?
There is. I mean, he has a budget, so he can decide how he wants to manage his budget and where he wants to focus his energies, right? So if he decides as a sheriff that his priority is going to be to lower violent crime and focus on illegal drug use, then he can focus that attention and he can steer his troops away from those laws that maybe some of the legislature they pass and that are important to them. And I can't necessarily think of an example that of a sheriff, but we tend to prioritize, at least here in California, the focus on Part One crimes, because that's how most law enforcement is measured, and those things that are more problematic for the community. So you see a lot of laws passed. I'll use the example of a lot of the gun laws that get passed, and whether the sheriff thinks they're unconstitutional or not. I mean, there's a lot of the gun laws that are passed. They're really meant to scare the honest public into compliance to what they want. But, you know, it's unlikely that the sheriff is going to start hunting down everybody that might have a clip that has more than 15 mags and rounds in California. They'll just use those laws when they arrest criminals, and criminals actually have to have it. I don't think we're not going to form a task force to go after every law-abiding citizen who might still have an assault weapon in their house. It's unlikely to do that. So sheriffs do have some latitude to disregard the laws that are, I will say, politically motivated by the legislature, because a lot of those, that's what this is all about. It's just a political motivation. But they will use them against the criminals. The terrible thing about that in LA County, at least, is, you know, we're passing all these laws to hold people accountable, yet at the AG won't even hold the criminals accountable. So yes, the sheriff, very much like the prosecutor, our DA who doesn't want to do certain things, has a great deal of latitude where they want to put their resources. Now, on the other hand, the board of supervisor gives them money, you know, they can dangle a carrot out there. Hey, well, we want you to, we're going to give you some money to do this, and we'll support your pet project. So there's some give and take there between the sheriff and the board of supervisors to maybe manipulate the sheriff's priorities based upon what their best interest. But most supervisors really want the sheriffs or police to focus on the street crimes, because that's what they get beat up. There's a lot of street crimes in their districts. That's what the voters hit them up on as well. So there's, if it's a healthy relationship, there should be a mutual interest on legislatures and the sheriff to enforce a lot of the same things. But every now and then there's some political deviations. But the sheriff can decide what he wants to enforce.
Okay, interesting. Thanks for that. And I'm curious, just sort of as a side here, what's your take on the future of the allowance of concealed carry in California, considering the New York ruling that came out, New York versus Bruin, I guess, New York Rifle and Pistol Association? The Supreme Court came down on the side of, telling cities basically that they can't do that may issue. They have to go with the must issue, because the may issue was like, well, we might issue it to you if you can prove you have a good need for it outside of your desire to defend yourself. How's this going to work in California? I mean, how does that happen there? It's going to be clearly the governor is not happy with it and already looking to figure out ways to buck it, much like the New York governor.
Well, I don't know if they've passed the legislation yet, but they do have legislation in the hopper. They already did pass some legislation. So they tailored a bill consistent with the legal framework that they used in Texas to go after abortion providers for you know, doing abortion. So they did that here so that they could sue gun manufacturers, and pretty much every gun they managed to write. It was a very lengthy bill. I read the bill. It was page after page what they laid out. And basically they gave the authority of anybody to go after a gun manufacturer if they're injured by somebody in the use of a gun, whether it's a crime or just accidental shooting, whatever. And they opened the door for lawsuits against the gun manufacturers. Now that's one. So that obviously the gun manufacturers are going to fight that. I haven't seen that translated any lawsuits yet, but that's already passed. The other thing that they did is, I don't know if they passed this legislature or not, but it was the concealed carry. They were addressing that right on. They wanted to change how concealed weapons are given in California. So right now they're the sheriff and chief of police in areas can give CCWs. And what they said in their legislation as a justification for what I'm about to explain here is that the sheriffs in different counties have different rules or different they have different criteria in terms of whether they'll give concealed weapons permit or not. So here it was, you had to have good cause, and the sheriff got to decide what that good cause was. So in LA County, under Sheriff Villanueva, he expanded the definition of what he thought good cause was, and we went from a few hundred CCWs issued mostly to just reserve deputy sheriffs when they're off duty to, I think his last count was up to about 3,000. So he has issued 3,000. So he puts them through the background check, and he determined whether they have good cause. Well, now that the Supreme Court said that you can't really use that good cause standard. He's just issuing them. So what the state is saying, what the governor is saying, or the legislature is saying, that is, it's been done different all over California, and we want to standardize it. And they are going to empower the state attorney general. Now, this is the same guy who, in his transparency website, released all the data and information on CCW holders in the state. I don't know if you're familiar with that story, but this is...
He accidentally
released this, right? And now this new legislation would empower him to create a licensing body that would standardize the licensing of CCWs throughout the state. And he would be in charge, and they would take that authority away from the sheriff. And they added a lot of criteria, which I felt was a direct attack on the Supreme Court's ruling. And I think one of the things that, because I read it a few weeks ago, one of the things I recall that they put in there is you would have to come in and do an interview. And to me, that felt like, well, how is that? So I come in, I got a mohawk that's painted purple and pierced ears. Is that going to change my ability to get a CCW if I don't have any felony convictions or anything else? I mean, what is the interview for? I don't get it. And so they had some criteria that I felt were an effort to challenge the Supreme Court and their assessment, and to force it back into the Supreme Court. Because if they add criteria to where they have a governmental employee making the decision, well, you know what, you just don't meet my criteria. Well, what does that mean? You know, so that's, you're going back to what the Supreme Court just threw out. For the Second Amendment, these guys have it. The government doesn't get to put extra hurdles, is basically what the Supreme Court said, in front of the law-abiding citizen to say whether they can carry a gun or not. And the government needs to issue them after they've passed a background check on reasonable conditions. And it seemed to me like this new bill would create unreasonable conditions and force this back to the court. But I think the big part of this is, for California at least, is they would take the authority away from the sheriffs and the chiefs of police. And my opinion there is, if I'm from LA, there's nobody from the state who's going to know who I am. You know, I'm a trusted community member. To them, I'm just the number. To the sheriff, I'm a member of his community. I think the sheriffs and the chief need to retain that authority. And I think the power grab, where they're going to take it away from the sheriffs, is wrong. And it's just an effort to try and control who gets what in the state of California. So I think the governor and the legislature are setting up political arguments to challenge the Supreme Court ruling. That's my assessment based upon the bills I read.
Interesting. Yeah, that's kind of been my take too, after seeing what I could see here, but you just added a lot of context. I appreciate that. Stick with me, Pat. We'll be right back. We're going to take a quick station break. This is Today's News Talk.
This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines. The Russian Foreign Ministry says that Ukraine's shelling of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant is an act of terrorism that could trigger a disaster that would eclipse the 1986 Chernobyl incident. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has said the responsibility for the conflict in Ukraine lies with the Russian government and not its people, and therefore it is hard to imagine a complete visa ban for Russian citizens.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio, or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's News Talk. This is TNT Radio.
That's right. Welcome back, everybody. My guest is a 38-year veteran and a retired chief of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. His name is Pat Jordan, and I always enjoy having Pat on the show. There's always so much to discuss, so much going on in this crazy world. And yeah, we're talking about firearms in California. We're talking about sheriffs and the role of the sheriff. And this is all extremely important stuff. And so, Pat, I agree with you. It seems like this whole, let's just add a whole bunch of red tape to it. Like, the Supreme Court just came out, and people waited so long for this decision with the New York Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, because it means so much to the nation as a whole, you know, and we've got about half of the states right now that have adopted constitutional carry. And then you've got other states and politicians and boards, and all these people trying to figure out how to buck that, how to get away with that. So they love these things like, oh, well, yeah, you can have a concealed carry here, but you're going to have to come in and do an interview. We're going to have to check your medical records. There might be mental health associated stuff. We might violate your HIPAA laws to figure out, you know, what kind of medications you might be on. We're going to make you take a week of classes, you know, not just the 4 8-hour day class that most people take in many states, all this added criteria. And to make matters even worse, maybe we'll just pass legislation that makes this happen via a government employee, a state government employee, instead of letting the chiefs of police and the sheriff's departments do their job in accordance with what the Supreme Court laid out. You know, so this seems to be a pretty shady tactic, and I see them doing this in New York as well. So what do we do to avoid that? Do people need to contact their legislators or their sheriff, or how do people engage in this decision-making process?
Well, it's they have to contact their legislature, although I think, you know, we have a political machine in California. So those that have to back off, we'll back off, and those who are in incredibly liberal districts will carry the sway. We have really no bulwark against this because they have super majorities in both the Assembly and the Senate, and they're really in lockstep on where they want to go. Unfortunately, in California, politics is driven by a lot of influence by Soros, the ACLU. I mean, the ACLU is one of the number one lobbyists in Sacramento. And it's amazing to me that the ACLU used to be about personal freedoms, and now the ACLU is sided with, you know, taking away your freedoms and in the name of, well, whatever excuse they come up with. So it's, you have to contact your legislature. You have to vote. I have a friend of mine who's running. I don't know if Bert's ever been on your show, but Burton Brink, he's running for the 49th Assembly District. He's a cop. He's trying to get the Sacramento to bring some sanity back to the decisions they're making up there. And but he's got an uphill battle as another guy. He's running, I think, for the 41st District, a retired LAPD officer. I can't remember Mark. I think it's Moffitt is his name, or Mike Moffitt's name. And we need to get some of these folks up there in Sacramento so they can start challenging the lies and misrepresentations spread out by lobbyists like the ACLU or Senator Scott Wiener up there in the up in the Bay Area, who just keep putting really bad legislation together and stop and force a discussion on this stuff. Because right now there's no discussion. Whatever they want, they just run it through the legislature. It's controlled all by Democrats, and everybody stays in line. Nobody fights it. I mean, Villanueva is a progressive Democrat, and they're trying to get him out of office. He's one of them, but he, you know, he kind of a maverick. He does what he wants. Some of it's been bad and some of it's been good, but all of it has been against what they want, right? So they just want him out, and they want to get somebody in there who will just go along with whatever they want. And that really is the fault of the voter. I mean, when you come to Western political thought, I'm a political science major. I love that stuff. Every government only rules by the authority of the people. Now, some of you say, well, there's dictatorships. Well, you know, dictatorships will overthrow dictators, right? But it really comes down to what you will tolerate and as citizens and what you won't. And if infringements of your freedom is a problem for you, then you need to start voting against those people that are taking them away from you. You need to challenge the language that they use. And that's one of the reasons why I come on these shows. They're decidedly anti-law enforcement, and I've been trying to challenge the language that they use. And I'll give you one that I'll, you know, just throw out there because I think your audience would appreciate it. They use disparate treatment, inequity. Those are the kind of things they say. That's why we got to get rid of mass incarceration, because the It impacts people of color greater than everybody else. But if you look at what went on in this country, particularly in California, and 1993, we had 13.1 homicides per 100,000. And 2014, when they passed Prop 47, we had 4.4. So all those, we saved thousands of lives with our tough on crime approach. Now, we could have probably handled the after the arrest part with a lot more treatment, and we didn't. But we did save a lot of lives. And the disparate treatment that they talk about, the communities of color were the ones that were most impacted by the violence. So when you lower crime, who benefits the most from the reduction of crime? Communities of color. You know, and there are more people alive today because of the tough stance we took on crime. There are more people who are able to have kids, start businesses, get jobs, and just live good lives. And you saw investment come into blighted areas, and people, you know, teenagers were able to get jobs. Now, as you see crime going up, you see that fading away. And the language they use to justify all of these bad policies is discrimination, disparate treatment. But the benefit of the policies that we had from the 90s all the way through till 2014, or even just before that when we started all these changes, the benefit went primarily to communities of color, and we never talk about that. And so when we talk about the language that they use, the people need to listen to what they're saying and then analyze it in a critical way and say, hey, these guys are full of it, because you know what? My dad told me in the 90s when there were rock houses, you couldn't even walk out in the streets in South Central LA. Now that all that's gone, you know, we got a Starbucks, we got investment, all this going on, and now that's all coming back because we relaxed all of these laws. People need to start looking around and asking, they sold us a bill of goods, it's not panning out, why are we doing this? Why are we supporting these folks? They need to think critically, and they need to vote according to their values and according to what's their best interest. And crime and homelessness is not in their best interest.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I've seen, you know, I've told you before, but I watch a lot of, you know, those YouTube videos, police activity and active self-protection. I like to see the badge cam stuff and all that stuff for multiple reasons. But I can't help but notice lately some of the things I'm seeing. I'm just, as someone, you know, a passive viewer who takes interest in this, I'm seeing a lot more young people committing crimes, like doing armed robbery and looting and stuff like that. And many of them don't end well, you know, and it's almost like it's been popularized. Like there's something with, you know, bills similar to Prop 47 that have emboldened people to think that violent crime is some sort of a career path now or something, or the fact that, you know, that if they're only going to steal less than $1,000 worth of stuff, it's just a misdemeanor and they're going to be back out, you know, before the end of the day. But like I saw two young people, hard to tell they were wearing masks, but I'm pretty sure they were young and dumb, go into a smoke shop and try to do a hold up on the guy that was working there. And one of them jumped over the counter, and he discovered once he jumped over the counter that the clerk there had a knife and he knew how to wield it properly. And I didn't see if this guy survived, if the aggressor survived, but it kind of looked like he took a gnarly knife stab into like the neck and shoulder area that looked like it could have been a fatal blow to me. And the last words that came out of this aggressor's mouth were, "I'm dead," you know? So it's like, it's really a problem here. You know, you're talking about how it benefited communities of color to have the tough on crime policies. And now what I'm seeing is youth and people of color, like, in particular, seem to really be gravitating to violent crime in a lot of different places. And it's almost like they've been advertised into doing this. I feel like there's almost a marketing campaign that has pushed a lot of people. You know, obviously there's a lot of other stuff going on, a lot of factors, economic and societal, but it just seems like the spike it's almost encouraged this.
Well, it reminds me of the 90s that we're going back to that. You know, if you go back and you look at the level of violence that existed in the 80s and 90s, I mean, there was between 1980 and 1993 were the highest level of homicides in California, at least, and I'm sure it was mirrored around the country. And then we passed these tough on crime laws, and they dropped from there, right? And there was real deterrence there. I know they keep saying studies show that the deterrence doesn't work. Well, that's, you know, I started dipping into the studies that they keep talking about, and you know, they'll take a kernel of truth in those studies, and they'll expand upon it and say, well, see, mass incarceration doesn't work. Well, mass incarceration did work because we can look at the results of that. The question is can incarceration work better? And that's like one of the things they talk about is, well, when we put people in prison who are not likely to recidivate, they come out with criminogenic factors, and then they're likely to recidivate. And what they're talking about, what they're saying is, when we're tough on crime and we put people in prison who, when you do an assessment, are unlikely to commit another crime after this one, by putting them in prison with people who are medium to high to recidivate, you increase the likelihood that they will then develop what they call criminogenic factors, antisocial behavior, impulsive thinking, and hanging out with other people who think that way, and begin a life of crime or continue a life of crime that they otherwise would not have. Now, that's a valid criticism, and there are studies that show that, but that isn't like should not be an excuse for not incarcerating people. What you do is you parse those people out. Either you look at those guys and you use alternative incarcerations for those guys, and there are surveys or questionnaires you can do that will assess their criminogenic factors, determine if there's somebody that needs to be locked up, or there's somebody that can be, we can use another alternative for them. Or if we do lock them up, we put them in an environment where they're with other low to recidivate type people. And I think domestic violence is an example. You know, if somebody gets one case or maybe a drunk driving, and not everybody returns to prison with those ones. A lot of them are low to recidivate. So housing them in one jail to serve their time might be a better way to go, and keeping them away from those that are medium to high to recidivate. So they take that piece of that study that shows that, and they expand it and says, see, putting people in jail makes criminogenic factors. No, that's not it. There are other people that we put in jail that are medium to high to recidivate, and keeping them away from the public to keep the public safe is legitimate. And so we just need to find a way to house them and keep them away from low to recidivate so they don't influence them. And so it's really about how we do it instead of just throwing it all out and saying that we're not going to do these things. So that's another area where they're kind of dishonest with the study. They take this one piece and they expand upon it and say, see, studies show. Well, it doesn't quite show that. It shows that we could probably manage our prison population better, or we could probably manage our punishment alternatives a little better to get better outcomes on our tough on crime approach.
That makes really good sense. I'm glad you broke that down for us, because there's a level of nuance there that you're utilizing in your description and your suggestions that will make sense to a lot of people, I think, because it's always just something binary. It's always this or that. It's always throw the baby out with the bathwater or double down. There's nothing in between. I love what you're saying here, Pat. Hang with me for one more break. We'll be right back, everybody. This is today's News Talk.
Anthony Fauci lied and people died.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Marano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Marano.
In a rewrite of history, Anthony Fauci is now claiming that he never recommended lockdowns in the United States.
I didn't recommend locking anything down.
That was Anthony Fauci in 2022, denying he had anything to do with lockdowns. But let's go to the audio. Here's Anthony Fauci in 2020.
I recommended to the president that we shut the country down.
Fauci saying I had nothing to do with it. Fauci admitting he actually recommended the lockdowns. And let us not forget, lockdowns killed, delayed medical treatments, depression, loneliness, poverty increase, which causes higher death rates. Isn't it time for Anthony Fauci to come clean and admit his grave error on COVID-19? For the Marano Minute, this is Mark Marano on TNT Radio.
emergency, police, fire or ambulance?
Yeah, I'm just passing through.
Police, fire or ambulance?
I can see a whole lot of smoke.
What town are you calling from?
I'm on a mobile phone.
I need the town.
Yeah, there it is. I can see flames. There appears to be a kid or something at the window.
It's okay.
You guys are better out. This is serious.
Hello?
000's sole job is to connect you to emergency services. If you stay focused and just answer the prompted questions, you'll get help faster.
Mainstream media censors, smears, and intimidates those telling the truth. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. I'm joined by Chief Jordan here. He's a law enforcement professional from the LA area. Chief Jordan, do you have an update on the Breonna Taylor thing? I was told I should probably ask you about that. What's going on there?
Well, you know, last week the feds prosecuted, they indicted four police officers from Louisville. And I'm glad you asked me the question because I wanted to really talk about, you know, what they did and what they're being prosecuted for. And then, you know, link that back to this whole Russian investigation with collusion with Trump, because I have a real problem with it. And when that first investigation started with Trump, you know, one of the things as a law enforcement officer who has been involved in either the writing, review, or execution of probably about 300 search warrants, I had a couple of teams that were very active for several years. And so I ended up having to review or go on a lot of search warrants. And with the whole FISA thing, that really bothered me that the FBI either lied or misrepresented to get the FISA warrant. And as this all is shaken out, that's exactly what they did. They bootstrapped some information that they got, the Steele document, suggested that it was that this guy who wrote it, Steele, was a credible actor, even as they understood that he wasn't, and more information came out that there was this document wasn't legitimate. They continued to use him and continued to sell him as a credible source. Even as he talked to the media, they used the media reporting as evidence that there's additional people who were aware of this to bootstrap the FISA warrant and keep it going against Trump. And I had a real problem with that because, see, the FBI investigates local law enforcement and hold them accountable for constitutional violations. And one of the things that they would go after folks for is if you violated somebody's civil rights by lying in a search warrant, they're the ones that come after you. And that's exactly what they're doing. The couple of these folks lied in the search warrant in Louisville. Those lies were the only reason that they were able to get the probable cause necessary to go into Breonna Taylor's house. And because of that, she ended up dying in that confrontation. So because of that, these guys will be prosecuted for civil rights violation and could face life in prison because a death occurred accordingly. Now, I have some issues with their logic there, but the big problem I have with it is, you know, they're saying that these guys bootstrapped their warrant by suggesting that they had contacted the post office and determined that one of the principals in the investigation lived at Breonna Taylor's house, and that they did a computer search and indicated that that was his residence, and they did in fact know that that was not his residence. Now, he did have prior a relationship with her. It was clear when you look at the warrant that she knew what was going on. There was drug dealing was the game, and she was to some degree knowledgeable of it, and that they were using her house for some reason, and there was legitimate probable cause to indicate that it could possibly be a stash house, right? At least in my assessment of the information, even without the bootstrapping of the probable cause by Louisville police, I still think they had enough probable cause to do that search warrant. That's the feds are saying that they didn't have that probable cause, which led to the murder, so they're going to be prosecuted. I think they do have a defense that there was still enough probable cause. But the real issue here for most of your listeners is the FBI and the Justice Department are going after these guys for bootstrapping a warrant to get into her house, and they're now prosecuting those guys. Yet at the same time, the FBI bootstrapped the FISA warrant, which is essentially a search warrant, to be able to go after Trump and to continue to go after Trump even after they knew that the probable cause that they presented to the judge was suspect, and they misrepresented those facts, and nothing has really happened to any of those guys. And that's my problem. So the folks that are policing the police have been held unaccountable in that situation. And I have a real problem with that. And I had a problem from the day one when I learned some of the facts on the FISA warrant, being an old detective. And I don't have a problem with them prosecuting Louisville guys if they did in fact lie in this case. I do think they have some defense in that the probable cause did exist even without them lying. So, but my thing is, you know, the public, when they question government, they need to, the FBI, they need to ask those tough questions. You know, is it rules for thee, but not for me? How come you guys are prosecuting these guys for bootstrapping and you have not prosecuted your own staff for bootstrapping the FISA warrant? That's a big problem for me. And I think it lends an argument that the FBI is not credible in a lot of things that they do. I think the latest thing at Mar-a-Lago and all these other stuff, you're just reminded, hey, you guys already lied once and you guys haven't cleaned house. You haven't corrected that and you haven't prosecuted people for it. So I do agree if these guys lied in Louisville, they need to be prosecuted, right? But I expect the Justice Department and the to deal with the FBI if they lied on the FISA warrant, and it appears like they did.
Yeah, that's kind of been my thinking too. I don't understand why the FBI, why we as a society, why our government allows the FBI to be used in this way, or why the FBI director allows his offices to be used in this way, or why the directors of offices allow this. Like, how many corrupt people are there in the chain when it comes to this kind of action? Because it's like I was talking earlier in the show about Hillary Clinton. She was given a week's notice that there was going to be a search warrant executed at her place where she had those servers, those illegal servers. She was given plenty of time to have her team in there changing those things. She deleted tens of thousands of emails with zero repercussion whatsoever. And then Trump, over a matter of treeware, you know, physical documents, gets this treatment, gets no warning, no lawyers allowed to stand by and see what's going on. And, you know, Hunter Biden, you know, there's just been so many cases where it's like, okay, if the FBI was going to be used in this way for this sort of political policing, the public could maybe feel a little bit better about it if it was working on both sides, but it's just become so apparent now that it's completely tied to the Democrat Party. And that just seems like something that should be a huge red flag to everybody, including Democrats.
I agree 100%. I think, most people don't remember, and certainly I was born in 62, but I was very interested in the whole Watergate thing as a young man. And I read the whole, All the President's Men. I watched the movies. And if you look back, you know, I mean, at the time, Nixon was using the intelligence services and the investigative services on his political enemies. And in this case, Clinton manipulated those services, probably to a great degree they were willing, to investigate Trump. And, and nobody seemed to have a problem with it on the Democratic Party, with the Democratic Party. And, you know, my thing is for all the law enforcement officers, because I like to speak up for our law enforcement officers. And I know that people make mistakes, and some of these guys made some mistakes, and they're going to pay a heavy, heavy price. But I would like to think that the investigative agency that is holding local and state law enforcement accountable to the Constitution themselves follow the Constitution. And when they don't, that they hold their own staff accountable. And I think I can honestly say that they haven't done that yet. And they've been resistant to do that. The mere fact that many of the leaders involved at the time can't even come out and say, yeah, we could have handled that one better. You see Comey defend himself and they got book deals, and McKay, the same thing. And they're enriching themselves off it. Yet they allowed a system where abuse was okay. And, you know, I don't know if it's because they were partisan Democrats or they're just, you know, they're big game hunting. Let me take down Trump and I'll get some book deals when I retire. You know, I'm not sure what it was, but the bottom line is, if I'm looking at it from a local perspective to an agency that comes down on local law enforcement, they did not have systems in place to keep this abuse from happening. They did not have systems in place to prevent that dishonest and inappropriate information wasn't submitted to the courts. And they did not follow up immediately when they found out these problems happened. They waited until they were actually investigated before they actually did anything. And that's shameful, and that calls in any investigations, including on Mar-a-Lago, just calls them and makes them suspected actors in this whole political game. So I have a real problem with that, and people should watch that, and people should call them out for their behaviors.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's Chief Jordan, everybody. Thank you, Pat, for joining me. I look forward to your next visit, per usual. Appreciate your input. That's it, everybody. We got to shut it down. Top of the hour news coming your way here on Today's News Talk. I'll see you tomorrow.